Thanks, Eileen. Thank you very much.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Enjoy the show.
Thank you very much, Dermot. Good afternoon on this Tuesday afternoon. So the relocation of the National Maternity Hospital from Holles Street in Dublin to St. Vincent's has been approved by the Cabinet. Yay! So 299 years of entanglement of the church and state. I would have thought that we aspired as a republic, a modern republic, to separate church and state, but now we're tied into it for 299 years. Not just us, but future generations of men, women and children. There you go. That's the way it is. Listen, this guy, Jake Daniels, this is an amazing story. And I don't know if people appreciate how amazing it is. He's a 17-year-old professional footballer in the UK. He plays for Blackpool and he's come out as gay. Now, this is historic. This is historic because Premiership football, you know, top flight football is amazing. It's amazing that over the years there have been but one gay footballer. It's like it, the statistics don't add up. So what we have to believe, I would imagine, is that a lot of men were in the closet while playing top flight football. That's I'd say that's a fact. And isn't it great that this 17-year-old now has had the courage to come out? He says, now is the time to do it. I feel like I am ready to tell people my story. I want people to know the real me. He says he's known his sexuality since he was 6 years old. He kept it as a secret as he pursued his dream, a dream to be a professional footballer, which a lot of young boys dream of being, and young girls. After a decision that had been some months in the making and involved consultation with his family, his club, the LGBTQ plus charity Stonewall and Sky Sports, who first reported the news, Daniels gave a considered explanation of why he chose to come out when generations of players before him had felt unable. For a long time, I've thought I would have to hide my truth because I wanted to be, and now I am, a professional footballer. I asked myself if I should wait until I've retired to come out. No other player in the professional game here is out. However, I knew that would lead to a long time of lying and not being able to be myself or lead the life that I want to. Since I've come out to my family, my club and teammates, that period of overthinking and the stress it created has gone. And he revealed that the day after coming out to his family, he had played for the club in a youth fixture against Accrington Stanley. I scored 4 goals, he said. So it just shows how much of a weight off the shoulders it was. There's Jake Daniels. Well done, Jake. Well done, Jake. Adults age 50 and over are best at being happy with what they have, study finds. It sort of makes sense. Sometimes you get older, you mellow a little bit and you become happy in your own skin. Holidays and time to spend on hobbies and interests featured in the top 10 things the over 50s are satisfied with, along with being debt-free, having good health and knowing the children are happy. So they interviewed 2,000 adults. Things that make adults over 50 feel serene also include learning to be happy with what they've got, over half, enjoying leisurely tea or coffee in the morning, about a third. It also emerged that 1 in 10 have a more active sex life than they ever had before. But that'll be the kids gone, won't it? You get a key for that door, for God's sake. Well, yeah, it's more to just getting a key. It's finding the time and the space and all that sort of thing. So that probably explains that. One of the advantages of empty nests, I would imagine. The study also found that those under the age of 30 described themselves as least content with life overall, stressing most about their finances and work-life balance. So that's positive if you're heading into your 50s. And there's a list of all the things that make people over 50 happy. I'm just looking at the top 10 there. It's the cup of tea, as mentioned, holidays, being comfortable financially, having time to spend on hobbies, interests, being mortgage-free, knowing your children are happy. Let's go down to the top 20. Cuddling the cat is at number 20. Having a nice car, number 19. Being happy with the way you look. Having freedom to travel. Knowing your pension is set up. Walking the dog. A nice view out of the kitchen window. Having a job you enjoy, time to perfect the garden, time with friends. Isn't that a, you know, in the world we live in, being happy with the way you look when you're over 50. You see, that flies in the face of all the stuff we're told, you know, because, you know, young people, Instagram, all that, it's all image, image, image. And yet something happens with the brain and how we mature and how we mellow, that when we hit 50 and, like, let's be honest, less hair, more jowls, more wrinkles, all of that sort of stuff, but yet happy with the way you look. That's, I don't know what that says about anything, but it's interesting. For people who follow Derry Girls, it's the last one tonight. Well, last one but one. It's a bit confusing. Channel 4 have told us that they're going to get the series finale for season 3 tonight at 9 o'clock. And then tomorrow at the same time, there's a 1-hour special that's set a year later. So it's the finale, but not the finale. And then there's a special tomorrow night. So for fans of Derry Girls, I have them all taped. I watched the first two, and I'm going to, as I said, one rainy weekend, I'll sit down and watch the rest of them. Looking forward to it. And Derry Girls star Nicola Coughlan has took to Instagram. We spoke to her last week from her house in Oranmore. It's there. Anyway, she's saying that her character in Bridgerton is going to feature big time in series 3. She says, like Lady Whistledown, which is her character, I've been keeping quiet a big secret for quite a long time, but I can finally tell you that season 3 is Colin and Penelope's story, and Penelope Featherington is her character. This update also suggests a change in the order from the original source material. The series is adapted from the books by Julia Quinn, and Lady Featherington's romance only features in book 4. So it's obviously testimony to the appeal, not just of the character, but of the person who's playing the character, which is Nicola Coughlan. Well done, Nicola. 51551 ray@rte.ie. We've a lot of things to get through today. We have an amazing young woman. Would you call her a young woman? Young girl from Tipperary, Artfin in Tipperary. Cara Darmody is coming in to talk to us with her dad, Mark. And we also have a chat with John Ronson, who is always very interesting. And he's done a series of podcasts on the culture wars, and we're going to be talking to about that. And then after 4 o'clock, we're talking to Melanie Murphy, who came to a lot of people's attention, firstly as a YouTuber. And now she's on her third book, which is called Glass Houses. And we'll be talking to her about that and other things after 4 o'clock. Of course, in the middle of all that, we have our quiz. Yes, we do. Yes. Reeling in the Ears, our daily quiz. We'll be looking for two of you to come on and answer 3 questions each on bits of songs, news reports, TV shows and movies. Yes. And we have a prize. Today's prize, a 2-night stay with dinner on one night at the 4-star Fairways Hotel in Dundalk. It's a great midpoint between Dublin and Belfast. It's the perfect place to gather family, friends and loved ones for your next getaway. While you're staying, discover Dundalk's beautiful scenery, history and heritage, and the bustling town centre with its many artisan shops and restaurants. One lucky listener will win a 2-night stay in a beautifully appointed bedroom with dinner on one evening in the Brasserie, Fairway Hotel's newest dining experience. You can find out more. Fairwayshotel.ie. Fairwayshotel.ie. We're looking for two of you to come on. Here is your qualifying question on this Tuesday afternoon. Which TV comedy about 4 teenage girls from Northern Ireland has its season finale this week? Which TV comedy about 4 teenage girls from Northern Ireland has its season finale this week? 0818715925. 0818715925. And good luck with that. Thank you very much, Mr. Commodores. And hello, Mr. George Michael. 51551 ray@rte.ie. Good afternoon.
Yeah, yeah!
Will you stop playing with that radio of yours?
There
I'm
you
trying
go.
To get to sleep.
Okay, yes. George Michael there and Too Funky. Mark and Cara in studio. We're going to talk to them after a quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Yeah, 51551 ray@rte.ie. Now, I'm going to read you something here. And this is how one of our next guests introduces herself on her GoFundMe page. I think that's the best thing we'll do. Okay. Hi, my name is Cara Darmody. I'm 11 years old. I'm in 5th class in Artfinnan National School. I have 2 younger brothers, Neil and John, who are both non-verbal with autism. They attend Scull Cormac Special School in Cashel. Our family are friends with so many other families that cannot get services such as speech and language, OT, play therapy and psychology. It really annoys me that nobody is doing anything about it. These kids are at a disadvantage due to the lack of services. So I want to do something about it. I want to raise money to give everyone the same chance. We need the money to help right now. So as I love maths, I decided last September to study the whole 3-year secondary school junior cycle ordinary level curriculum in maths. That's a mouthful, Cara. And I've done it in 8 months with the help of my school and my parents. Thanks to everyone. I'm now going to attempt to sit the junior cycle maths paper on June 10th, 2022, with all money received to be split equally between the two schools. I really hope you can donate and help. I really need your help with this project. Thank you so much, your friend, Cara, which also means friend, doesn't it? Your name means friend.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Cara Darmody is in with us in studio, and so too is her dad, Mark. Good afternoon, and thanks
so
much.
Good afternoon, Ray. Thank you so much. Hello.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's amazing. We've told your story already, but we want to find out a lot more about you and your brothers and your family life. So, day off today?
Yeah.
What's the name of the school?
I go to Arfin National School.
And you're in fifth, as we find out already.
Yeah.
And you're 11.
Yeah.
And you like maths.
Yeah, I do. I love maths.
Yeah. When did you discover that you liked maths?
It was when the lockdown hit that I realised that I was really strong at maths and that I could push ahead and I could do something special, and that since and that I could use my knowledge of maths to my advantage, and it's brought me here to the RTE place today.
Yeah, it has, and this is something special, as we've laid out there, is that you're fundraising to help services for people and families with autism.
Yes.
Yes. Now, tell me about your two brothers, what their names and their ages.
Well, my brothers are, I have two brothers and they're Neil and John, and Neil is 9 and John is 5, and they're both severely autistic and nonverbal, which basically means they can't talk and like they don't understand comprehension. And
right.
And the reason why, one of the reasons why I'm doing the fundraiser is because like kids like Neil, like it's like, it's like he's like 9, he's 9 years old, but it's like he's like, it's like he's in, he has like a 9 months old brain trapped in a 9 year old's body, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And does he get angry, do you think?
Yeah, he often has these meltdowns, and I always get like frustration, not with them, but I get frustration that like if the HSE was giving them these services, that like they wouldn't be having the same meltdowns. Mm. The meltdowns would be a lot less violent. Like he often whacks himself on the head and bites his finger and all that.
How do you feel when you see that, Cara?
It makes me feel like very like upset, but also very like frustrated, like at the HSE that like they're not doing anything about this, because the HSE is saying they'll do it, and the HSE is all talk and they're no action. So I want to be misaction.
You're misaction, right?
Yes.
So you're taking it into your own hands and you're doing this. This is amazing. I'm going to say this again because people may have missed it. So you're 11, right?
Yes.
And you're taking on junior cert maths.
Yes.
Okay. So this is something you shouldn't be doing for the next, what, do the maths on it,
four years.
4 years, yeah, there you go, yes.
Yeah.
Wow. That's brilliant. Has it ever been done before?
No, it hasn't.
This is, you're the first. So you'll be the youngest person to ever take a junior cert maths paper.
Yeah, like the youngest person to ever like officially take the paper, yeah.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Mark, was this all Cara's idea, and how did you feel?
Yeah,
and Noel, your wife,
Ray. I don't know if I need to add anything. I suppose I was having a cup of tea one September day, and she came in and she said, "Daddy," she said, in the way that she talks like that, and she said, "I'm just coming up with a great idea," and she said, "I'm going to raise money," and she was basically telling what she was saying, but then she said, "I'm going to sit the junior cert mats." Now I was waiting for her to say, "I'm going washing cars," or "I'm going to throw a few footballs," or something, and my jaw just hit the ground. Like I literally could have done with CPR. But she said to me then, I said to her, but pal, I said, the school probably won't be able to cater for this. Oh no, Daddy, that's the best news. You will be teaching me as well. So then I'm thrown into it. So look, fast forward 8 months, here we are. She's ready to go.
Ready to go?
Ready to go,
I'm ready to go.
We have, I think it's half a chapter to finish, but we're revision mode now,
right.
And she's up for this and she's well able for it. But I suppose it's the issue that has brought us to national attention. The fact that an 11-year-old is bringing up the lack of services issue seems to have caught serious traction at political level. And I suppose, that may be something you want to mention there.
Yeah, no, I do. I'm just looking at, I was reading an article there from the Irish Times, and these are the national figures for children with disabilities. 8,000 number of children on speech and language waiting lists, 9,000 the numbers waiting on psychology, 18,000 numbers waiting on occupational therapy, that's OT, 9% estimated number of assessments completed in time in the year 2019-2020. So the system is broken, isn't it?
It is. I suppose, you know, we have the two boys severely autistic, and I suppose, you know, our family, and we are not making this issue about us, and this fundraiser is not for us. It is for every other family. So like, she is the most selfless human being. I know I am biased, but like, this is for everybody else, and she's doing this. But okay,
I'm interested in getting inside your house.
Sure.
Because you have two. Okay. No, not really. Although if I'm passing by, I will call in for a cup of tea.
Talking about Neil and John look, we can give the direct comparison. So like, Neil is 9, okay? He did not get the services at the time at all. Now, I suppose the consequences are, because everyone talks of lack of services, what you never hear is, show me the consequences of the lack of service. So basically, you're talking about violent meltdowns where he will basically bite his own hand, he will strike himself, he will just hurt himself, because there's a psychological aspect to that. He is totally untitled trained. He is not tighter. He will never be, because the window has basically.
So does he wear a nappy?
Yes.
He has to wear a nappy.
And again, look, it's national radio. I'm sorry, but I mean, like, somebody has to show the courage, and we're going to do that today. So like he would be in the bed. Like, one of us as parents has to remain with him at all times. That's 24/7. So we'll say, like, last night, I didn't get to sleep with him until 4:30. That would be because he doesn't understand time. He doesn't understand that it's nighttime. He doesn't understand that I have to go to sleep. Even like last week, I mean, people can just graphically get this. It's where he goes to the toilet within the bed and we don't notice it. And then you're there for 24 hours trying to clean that up. These are the actual consequences of the lack of services. John, on the other hand, we were a little bit more clued into this. He was diagnosed then at 1 3/4. But then the HSE don't diagnose until he was 4.5. So if we
Where did you get the diagnosis then?
Privately. This is where the controversy is about parents having to seek private diagnosis. So like, while the HSE is telling us we're on a waiting list, we're kind of almost putting them to one side. We go about everything privately. And look, where we are with John is, there's a small comprehension with toilet training. We've made very subtle progress. There's subtle progress with comprehension. He is severe, but he's making more progress than Neil.
As you laid out there, early diagnosis is important, so you can get the services to get the best possible result for Neil or John. And Neil wasn't lucky enough.
No, he wasn't. And at the time,
so if he had the services, he would be toilet trained. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm basically saying is, I suppose one can never predict, you know, what's going to happen. Yeah. But what I can say is, when the services are not there, because you need professionals, we're just not professional in this field. We don't have the psychological training or the ability.
You as parents,
absolutely parents. Okay. So you are relying on the HSE to actually provide that. But even when the diagnosis comes, Ray, and this is the problem, at 4.5, that's only the beginning of you requesting services. So in South Tipperary right now, once you request a speech and language service, you're talking 2 years of a waiting list right now. So, I mean, you can do the maths there. You're into 6 and 7 before you even see someone for the first time.
But Mark, the frustration as a parent, knowing that if you got those services immediately, the difference it would make to your son, that must be very frustrating for you.
It is extremely frustrating. And I suppose my wife is at home. She would have loved to have come up here, but she can't, because the needs of the boys are like so severe. Noelle is at home with them. And, you know, we've managed to, for ourselves, to obtain some level of home care help and things like that. But we'll say, like, and those are bigger issues when it comes to respite and home care help. But we'll say, we have a psychological report that from the HSE, actually, that basically would say that for us to toilet train the boys, that we would actually need home care help in almost permanently for that to be done. So it actually, even with John, it's a struggle, even with extra help, because it's 24/7 thing. Like, you just have to constantly do it. So I suppose these are the things that parents listening, you know, we all took for granted. I didn't understand the disability world until we found ourselves in it. But I suppose you like,
it's not a club anybody wants to be in.
No, it's basically, as Cara said, like, that Neil is like a 9-month-old trapped within a 9-year-old's body. So you can imagine, if your baby who throws the bottles and the tantrums and all that, imagine if they could walk around. And
he's only going to get bigger and bigger, and the problems are going to get bigger and bigger.
Well, it gets worse every year. It's got, we would do statistics with the meltdowns and stuff like that. It doesn't get better. It is, as like you were saying, it gets way worse.
Neil and John's name were mentioned in the Dáil last week. So Micheál Martin knows who you are.
Yeah, he does.
Cara, which is brilliant, Cara Darmody. So would you hope then, Cara, that Micheál Martin, knowing who you are, knowing what you're doing, know your situation at home with Neil and John, that he will do something about it?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's definitely.
That's his job, isn't it?
Yeah, it's his job. Like, since he's the Taoiseach, like, he should, like, be helping all these people, but he's not. So I want to make the message clear to him that, like, that this is what happens when they don't get the services and that he needs to, like, help these people.
Yeah. I think you're amazing, Cara, because it's, like, and, you know, you come up here and you're it's a day out and everything, but the reality of your home life, and I think people got a bit of a flavour of that, it's tough. Isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is.
Yeah. And do you ever get a break? Do you get a break from Neil and John?
Well, I suppose I do try to help out sometimes, but I always feel bad for, like, Mam and Dad, because Mam and Dad have to take them 24/7. And often, sometimes, what could happen is Neil mightn't go to sleep some nights. So sometimes Daddy here, he could go, like, 4 to 5 nights without any sleep whatsoever.
That's tough, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know what I'm like if I lose a bit of sleep. Does he get a little bit annoyed when he loses sleep?
Yeah, I always wonder how Dad does it, like, because yeah. I would not be able to do it in a million years.
He's sort of Superman, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely.
He's Superman, right.
That's not even up for debate.
No, okay, here's a quick algebra question for you. Right, 2y plus x is equal to 9. If x is equal to 1, what's y equal to?
Of 4.
Yes. Top of her head. Didn't even prepare her for it. There you go. Well, you looked worried there. That I just So you've algebra sorted anyway.
Yeah.
Well, what are you working on currently for the maths thing?
Well, we did like the whole like sine, cos, tangent yesterday and functions, although it was very hard. And yeah, when it gets very hard, it's definitely not as enjoyable than doing Venn diagrams or something easy like that.
Yeah, she's actually done, Ray. She's actually done 350 extra hours. We've actually clocked 350 extra hours over the last 8 months. I mean, it is.
So the logistics of it is that somehow you're going to get the paper on the day. You're going to sit it a little bit after everybody else sits it in a room in your school.
Yeah.
And brilliantly, your teacher and everybody in school is facilitating you to do that.
Yeah, the principal, Miss Quinn Livin, she's liaising with all that, and it's all arranged, but it's ready to go, which is amazing. Yeah.
So how do you feel now that you've been catapulted onto national radio? Your picture has been in papers, name mentioned in the Dáil. You've been on Tip FM with Fran.
Well, I feel really confident. I feel like that maybe, just maybe, something will be done about this, and that maybe these problems will be fixed a lot more, and that people will start paying more attention to what's actually happening.
Yeah, I hope. I hope, Cara. And it shouldn't take an 11-year-old to, you know, to get people working on what they should be working at. But there you go. And I think you're brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, although it's better to fix the problem now than never.
Yes, yeah, that's fair enough. You're right. GoFundMe.com. And if you go in there and you go, Cara's Extraordinary Maths Challenge. Because it is extraordinary.
Yep, but you can also just type up Ard Finnan and the first one will come up, to keep it simple if some people don't know how to spell extraordinary or something like that.
And everything raised is going to services for children with autism in the Tipperary area.
In Skull Cormac Special School and Ard Finnan.
Yeah.
And just to mention, Ray, there finally, that Fianna Fáil have notified us through their TD, Jackie Cahill, that a meeting is pending with the Taoiseach, and we will have a date and time for that next week.
Right.
And I suppose what I would say to anyone listening is, who is even considering this fundraiser, is to give us a mandate going in there. The more money she raises and the more people who donate, even if it's only a euro, it's to send a clear message to the Taoiseach that we will sit down and we will certainly, because the last point that I make is this, I don't think anyone has ever shown them videos of violent children. I don't think that they've ever seen it.
Well, it's been on primetime. Yeah. There have been a number of primetime specials and people have seen it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if politicians have sat down and watched it, but...
The politicians that we've spoke to, it's actually been amazing how little that they know about this topic and how the consequences affect. But I just ask people to take a look at the fundraiser, give us that mandate going in, because we will be sitting down with the Taoiseach, which is amazing for someone 11 to achieve that. And
No better woman. We'll be hearing more from you, Cara Darmody. Mark, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
And enjoy the rest of your day, whatever you're doing.
We will.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551, ray at rte.ie. John Ronson is coming to Dublin next month, which is good news for his legion of fans in this country. Author of The Psychopath Test, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, The Men Who Stare at Goats. John is bringing his live show, Things Fell Apart, which is based on his hugely popular podcast, to Dublin's Liberty Hall on Friday, June 10th. And I'm delighted to say John is on the line now. Good afternoon, John.
Hi, Ray. It's a pleasure to talk to you as always.
Good to talk to you. So Things Fell Apart. I think it's an attempt by you to throw water on the raging fires of the culture wars. Is that it, or is that...
Yeah, or certainly on the intensity with which they're being fought. Like many, you know, obviously there's many culture wars that are fought for good reasons. However, something's happened the last few years that means they're being fought with such an intensity online that it's turning people... I mean, it's turning some people crazy. People are losing their families, they're losing their reputations, losing all of their work. It's swallowing them up. And I was watching this sort of feeling quite melancholy, like these talented people are just, you know, throwing everything away to fight a culture war. What's going on? What's happening? So that was my question. Why is this intensity happening now?
And for the purposes of your podcast, and maybe to help out our listeners, how do you define a culture war?
Sure. Maybe the best definition I read was the battle for dominance over conflicting values.
Right.
So the first big modern culture war, when I say modern, I think you go back to the early 1970s for the genesis of what's happening today. So the earliest ones were over abortion and over diversity of thought in school textbooks. The ones that are probably raging at their hottest right now are transgender rights and critical race theory. Those are the two big ones currently.
Okay, so we'll go through some of those. Roe versus Wade is back in the news in America. And in one of your episodes, you trace the origins of the violent reaction to abortion in America. It's a story that starts with a father and son coupling, Francis and Frank Schaefer. Tell us about them.
I mean, this story I'm about to tell you is a completely unknown story and an extraordinary one. Francis Schaefer was a Christian art historian, kind of twinkle-eyed Willy Wonka sort of vibe about him in Switzerland in the late 60s. His son, Frank, was a very ambitious young man. He wanted to be big in Hollywood. So the Schaefers were given $3.5 million to make a documentary series about art history. And the young son had a personal bugbear about abortion. He was a teenage father at 19. This was about 5 years after Roe versus Wade, and the only people protesting Roe versus Wade at the time were Roman Catholics. Christian evangelists, it just wasn't an issue for them. It was a non-issue. They were pro-choice or ambivalent at best. As a result of this father and son making this documentary series with all of these very arresting visual images about 1,000 dolls on the beach baking under the, you know, these yes. kind of visual images. He only put them in because he wanted a showreel to show Hollywood producers. That was his only ambition, was to make it in Hollywood. As a result of these documentaries and this arresting visual images, the entire Christian right anti-abortion movement began because of this father and son. And of course, doctors were murdered. And of course, now, 50 years later, Roe versus Wade is about presumably to be overturned again. And it's a manufactured, manipulated outrage, which is just so interesting. I guess we just don't care. Like, when we're furious about something, we probably don't care why we're furious, whether we were manipulated.
And does it matter, you see? That's the thing, John. Does it matter? The origins of these things, does that actually matter?
Does it matter? Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think it's fascinating that far away people, far away men, manipulated us all yes. into our rage. I mean, so I think it matters in that regard. I don't think it probably matters to the people who are doing the fighting right now, because when the flame is burning hot, we don't care how we got there.
It's listening to this, and like, I found it really enlightening and engaging and entertaining and brilliant, and really added to my understanding of what's happening in the world. But you can't sit everybody down and put a pair of headphones on them and insist that they listen to John Ronson's podcasts.
But you can force them all to come to Liberty Hall on June 10th.
No, you can, yes. And that brings me nicely on to the next question, John, because were you fearful at any stage? Because it is very black and white, isn't it? It's very polarised. So people are going to decide which side you're on and act accordingly.
Well, yeah, and that does happen from time to time. I feel very lucky that all of these years I've been quite immune to too much criticism. Because I tell stories with curiosity and empathy and kindness, and I tell human stories with twists and turns, and I try and avoid ideology as much as I can. I tend to not get attacked too much, and when I was making this show, I did think, only an idiot would make a show about the culture war, especially a conflict-averse idiot like me.
Yeah.
But a little part of me thought, if I tell human stories, everyone can relate to that.
Okay, and you do. And you, say, for example, you tell the story of QAnon through the story of Isaac Cappy. Tell us about him.
Isaac Cappy was a talented young man in Hollywood in the early 2000s. Hollywood, the edges of Hollywood are such melancholy places. People trying to make it and they can't make it because it's so competitive and you get more and more bleak feeling. And that's what was happening to Isaac. He had more successful friends than him. He was spending too much time on the internet. And he said to one of his more successful Hollywood friends, I'm beginning to think that there's a paedophile conspiracy in Hollywood. And his friend said, his friend looked very serious and said, it's true. And I have a fake wall in my house. And if you come behind that fake wall, I have a child held captive. And now the guy was obviously playing a prank on.
Yes, the context of this was Pizzagate and the fact that people believed that very powerful people in Washington had a paedophile ring which operated from the basement of a pizza restaurant just outside Washington.
Yeah, and a guy went into the pizza restaurant with a gun and discovered, to free the children.
Okay.
And discovered that not only were there no dungeons in the basement and no kidnapped children, there wasn't even a basement.
Right.
The pizza restaurant didn't have a basement.
So Isaac fell hook, line and sinker for this prank that his so-called friends played on him. And then he became a poster boy, did he, for QAnon and conspiracy theory?
Yeah, a thought leader. He became a thought leader for QAnon. We don't realise, these little human moments, Frank Schaefer's ambition to make Hollywood films, Isaac Cappy believing his friend's stupid prank, these little human moments are what are the pebbles thrown in the pond which have now turned into a hurricane.
Yeah, how does that work? You've obviously thought about this. How does a notional thing in somebody's brain turn into a mass movement with a lot of power? How does that? Is there a want? Is there a want in us as human beings to believe, to belong? What is it?
Yeah, and I think sort of magical thinking, for want of a better phrase, has been a part of human life forever. And I think part of the problem is that the internet has brought all the magical thinkers together. It used to be, I'm a magical thinker who believes in, UFOs or conspiracy theories over there, or wellness, or, paedophile cabals. Now they've all got together. They've all united. And the reason why they've united is because of the way that the billionaire tech utopian libertarians who created the internet designed the internet. The internet was designed for this chaos.
So it was designed to polarize. It was designed to divide. It was designed to appeal to extremes.
Yeah, all of those things, and also designed to allow free speech to just flourish unencumbered. Free speech in all of its myriad guises, including, lies and abuse and harassment. These libertarians who created the internet very strongly felt that free speech, just exactly what Elon Musk is saying today about, why he wants to buy Twitter. And that was, we had no choice. We had no choice. That was the world we all lived in.
Well, let's talk about Twitter for a while, because I heard you say, I think, to Louis Theroux, a quote from the head of Twitter in England, we are the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party. And Elon Musk is out there shouting from the rooftops that, you know, he wants to bring free speech back to Twitter, saying that he wouldn't have banned Donald Trump from Twitter. Is it right? Is it proper? Is it good for the world that a man can buy this power for $44 billion? What do you think?
Because, you know, free speech absolutism. They like to see themselves as unideological, but it's a very ideological position, free speech absolutism. It really is. It's like, of course it sounds good. Everybody wants, you know, every reasonable liberal person wants free speech to run, because you see the dangers of restricted speech. But yes, we've lived in this experiment for the last 30 years. And what happened? The fact is, what happened was you had people trying to destroy democracy. You had mass harassment. You had, you know, abuse. You had a proliferation of dangerous, dangerous lies. The fact is, right, like, I would always consider myself a free speech absolutist, but that experiment failed.
Okay.
And the fact is, if Elon Musk takes over Twitter and brings it all back again, Twitter will fail, because we don't, you know, society doesn't want that. Mm-hmm. A small group of
wanted. Yeah. Just on the culture war, is probably one of the big weapons, the sort of the nuclear option of the culture war is cancellation, isn't it? It's to cancel somebody. And I suppose you spoke about that in your book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. You were talking about it really before anybody else was talking about it. Where is it at now? I feel that public adult discourse on important things has been muted.
I mean, things are very bad and very extreme, because that the whole cancel culture debate has become just a mess, because it just means so many different things to so many different people. It's a phrase, those two words incorporate a vast number of completely different sets of situations. Okay.
How do you understand it?
Well, for me, it means the disproportionate punishment of private individuals that haven't really done anything wrong.
Right.
Like, if a politician sexually assaults somebody and then, you know, bleats that they're being cancelled, that's a whole different thing.
Of course.
Putin talked about cancellation as part of his invasion of Ukraine. So all that stuff is clearly ridiculous. But then you've also got people on the left who say, oh, cancel culture doesn't exist. It's just holding people accountable, and it's always been that way. And there is some truth to that. There's some truth that if you're an agent provocateur columnist, you could be piled in on before the internet existed. But of course, the way that the internet goes means that those things have become much more extreme and much more ubiquitous. So there's some gaslighting going on when the left say that it doesn't exist, I'd say.
Right. Now, talk to me about Nancy. Nancy was a transgender woman, and you traced her story, and you attached it to the term TERF and some of the war that's going on around transgender politics at the moment.
Yeah, it's an interesting story how the word TERF came to be. Nancy, trans woman, she would go to this women-only festival called Mitch Fest in Michigan. And she went there 1 year and had a wonderful time. And there were other trans women there. I don't think very many, but there were other trans women there. Anyway, the second time she went, a woman went up to her and said, you know, you're not, are you a man? You're not welcome here. You have to leave. You have to leave now. And so she left. And they set up camp the following year, Camp Trans. And there's an argument that, you know, an awful lot of the modern transgender movement started at Camp Trans. And at the beginning, it was really a place to try and heal rifts between the two communities. And it worked for a while. There was, you know, meetings of minds and so on. Anyway, that'll, you know, obviously fell apart over the years. And the word TERF was originally invented about that particular incident. Should somebody like Nancy be allowed into this particular festival? And they tried to find a term for women who didn't want to allow trans women in, and the term was trans exclusion and radical feminist. Wasn't a term of abuse at all, but obviously, like everything else, it's become a term of abuse.
And you spoke to the woman who coined the phrase.
Yeah, and she's like, oh my God, you know, I wanted this to be a factual term. I didn't want it to be a thing that people like scream at each other about.
Because we've no control. Once we say something, we've really no control of it then.
You know, it's a very difficult. It's very, very hard for anybody to talk about, for people to talk about transgender issues, because it's such a minefield, and there's an awful lot of people involved who are very ready to argue in bad faith and scream and shout. And
okay, well,
the whole thing is just so. It's like, yeah, how can you have a how can you have a any kind of civilized conversation or debate when it's that serious?
It appears to me there are no winners from this, because. If you can't talk openly and ask questions about a marginalised group in society and get people familiar with the language, well, then it remains taboo in a way, you know. And if people like you, and I can hear it in your voice, are afraid to have open adult discussions, well, that's not good, is it? Is it?
Well, it's certainly not going to. Certainly not going to bring people into the fold.
No,
it's all it's going to do is make people stay away.
Yeah, Tammy Faye. Now, I don't know if you've seen the movie. You've seen the movie The Eyes of Tammy Faye, which is it's a biopic of this female evangelist, herself and her husband Jim, were some of the most famous TV evangelists in the States. And one particular interview she did, you say was a moment.
Yes, this is the reason why I think people should come to Liberty Hall on June the 10th.
Because
everything we've talked about so far has been about why the world fell apart. I have a story, this beautiful story, which is about how things can come together. And it's about Tammy Faye. I actually did the story before
the movie.
I knew that I knew about this story for years, and I've always wanted to find a way to tell it, so I'm glad I got the opportunity. Tammy Faye Baker was a televangelist. Her peer group were extremely homophobic, to the extent that Jerry Falwell, the kind of lead televangelist, convinced Ronald Reagan to not say the word AIDS in public for 4 years.
Wow.
They wanted the virus to spread in silence. Tammy wasn't having this and invited a pastor with full-blown AIDS, a gay pastor with full-blown AIDS, onto her show. Never had anything like this ever happened before. And I kind of don't want to say what happened.
If people saw the movie, they'll know about Pastor Steve Peters, and it is an amazing story. And what I'm interested in, and maybe you might know because you spoke to Tammy Faye Baker's son Jay, in the film, and that's sort of, you know, for dramatic effect, it looked like her world was falling apart as she did this, and maybe it was sort of a reaction to what was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, she was being... I mean, I know a lot about the Tammy Faye story. I could do Mastermind on this.
That'd be a good one. It seems like they're looking for new topics. People come with the same things over and over again. Kardashians.
Now somebody's already done Randy Newman. Tammy was being ostracised by her peer group, and she had various anxiety and depressive disorders, or certainly anxiety disorders. She started wearing makeup. She wore more and more makeup, and her peer group would call her like a French whore. You know, they'd insult her for her makeup, and then she'd put on more makeup. It was like a suit of armour. And so she was being mocked and ridiculed by her own peer group, and she was very alone. And I think what's so interesting is that in her loneliness, she found herself identifying more with the objects of her peer group's scorn than with her peer group Yeah. And I think that's something for all of us, you know. Sometimes identifying with the objects of scorn can take you to a new place.
She was not dissimilar to Dolly Parton, and she was a singer and used to break into song in the middle of her shows. And we there's a lovely moment in the I'm just teasing them here, John, not telling them. There's a lovely moment in the podcast where Pastor Steve Peters does his own version of this song. So if you're doing nothing over the weekend or next week or whatever, you can watch that movie and listen to John Ronson's podcast. Or you can go along to Dublin's Liberty Hall on Friday, June 10th. Things fall apart. John, are you hopeful for the world? Because it's black and white, isn't it? The nuances, the greyness in the middle, which is the reality of life, seem to have disappeared in a lot of places.
I'm hopeful in to the extent that I think a younger generation coming along are more interested in the nuances and the ambiguities than their older siblings. I think, you know, I think 12-year-old kids today are like, do we really want to live under this incredibly frightening set of rules that our older siblings have created? Like if we say something slightly wrong in our life. So that's what I'm hopeful is that. Yeah.
And will we ever reach a time where the big tech companies are answerable for what they let go through their platforms?
Oh, gosh, I wish.
It has to happen, though. Does it not have to happen? No, it doesn't have to happen. I'm naive, am I?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I hope that if Elon Musk buys Twitter, it's a disaster and he loses billions and he goes back to what he should be doing, which is creating an exciting utopian future of quiet cars and quiet aeroplanes.
Right. It's always great talking to you, and people can hear those stories that we've touched on in more detail and many more if they go to Dublin's Liberty Hall on Friday 10th of June. Things Fell Apart, a live show based on the hugely popular podcast. John Ronson, thank you very much. Mind yourself.
You too, Ray. Thank you.
Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Gormaga Coit, thank you very much. Lovely reaction coming in to Cara and her dad, Mark. Cara's brilliant. Her dad is right. HSE Disability Service lack of help for parents is heartbreaking. We fought for a diagnosis for our autistic son for almost 4 years. When HSE eventually diagnosed him, they were not able to provide staff for the therapies they recommended. Wow. After 6 years of waiting for HSE to give service, they then sent us a letter saying that he was being taken off the list because he had not received any services. Oh, God. Private occupational therapy saved our child after HSE abandoned him. And Cara Darmody is a fantastic advocate. Taking the Junior Cert maths exam to raise awareness is genius, but she shouldn't have to battle for her brothers to have a childhood, says Sarah. And Orla in Cork says, quite simply put, Cara is amazing. How lucky your two brothers are to have her, and she's a credit to her parents. She's an 11-year-old heroine, and what a champion she is for autistic people to draw attention to this ongoing dilemma. Micheál Martin is listening. Let us see the government take action. They can move fast when they see fit to do so, says Orla in Cork. And it's not the last we'll be hearing about Cara Darmody. I can guarantee that. Now, it's time to do our daily quiz. Press that button there. There you go. Yeah. Yep, reel in the ears. We have two quizzers standing by and we have a prize today. And the prize today is a one-night stay at the four-star Fairways Hotel located in the heart of Dundalk. No, it's not. It's a two-night stay with dinner on one night. There you go. Sorry about that. I just saw the one night there. It's a two-night stay with dinner on one night. The four-star Fairways Hotel located in the heart of Dundalk. A great midpoint between Dublin and Belfast. And you can discover Dundalk's beautiful scenery, history and heritage and the bustling town centre. Loads of arts and shops there. You can find out more. Fairwayshotel.ie, fairwayshotel.ie. And it's a two-night stay in a beautifully appointed bedroom and dinner on one of the evenings in the Brasserie, Fairway Hotel's newest dining experience. Hello, Katrina Carey.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Great to talk to you.
Great to finally get through to you, Ray.
Is it Wicklow Town or Wicklow County? And if so, go on.
It's
actually Roundwood, which is just below Glendalough in County Wicklow.
Lovely part of the country.
Yes, beautiful.
Oh, it's lovely up there. You're very lucky.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And well, I'm originally from Enniskerry, which was right beside Powerscourt.
Well, that's beautiful as well.
Absolutely gorgeous. That would be my childhood walk down to Powerscourt.
Yeah, well, they're similar, aren't they? Quite similar.
Yes, they are.
So you've never left the Garden County?
Not really, no. I did go to England for a few years, you know, in my wild youth.
Right.
Came back again and, you know, appreciated my parents and everything. Came back when my daughter was about a year and a half, lived in London with her and came back and just glad to be
and
back
home.
And
is that daughter 32 now?
That's right. Yeah, that's Nadine. She's 32. She's a social worker. And she, then my youngest daughter is 19.
What's her name?
It's a bit of a gap. Darina.
Darina.
Darina. Yes. D-A-R-R-E-N-A.
Is that a female iteration of Darren?
It is, yes.
All right.
You know, her dad's name is Darren and my name is Rena, short for Katrina. And when I was pregnant, when I gave birth to her, I said to Nadine, who was 13 at the time, I was trying to involve her, you know, not let her feel left out. And I said, now you can all choose a name that you like. And she said, I'd like Caitlin. And then her dad said, oh, I'd love Lucy. And I said, oh my God. And so afterwards, they reminded me that I had said that, you know.
Yeah.
But when she was born, I looked at her and she was Darina. I just looked at her Darina. So they reminded me and we hadn't named her. And I said, actually, I've changed my mind because I carried her for 9 months. I gave birth to her. And, you know, she's Darina. No, we put the names in the hat. The names went into the hat.
Oh, did
and
they?
I prayed to God. I said, please, God, let
Darina
come out.
Lucy, what was the other one?
Caitlin
and Darina.
Names, Ray. You know, they're fine names, but they weren't Darina. They weren't my Darina.
And Darina was drawn out of the hat. Yeah.
Darina, thanks be to God, was drawn out.
And
is
there a
Darina.
Family story about you writing Darina on three pieces of paper and putting it into a hat? Is that a family story? No, I'm joking.
I wouldn't have got away with it.
No, they would have checked.
Would not
Stuart's
have got
inquiry.
Away with that.
They get KPMG in. Yeah. Okay, you're up against Paul O'Hara. Paul is from Dublin and he's on holidays in Sligo. Hello, Paul.
Hey Ray, how you doing?
Good. You're in the middle of your holidays. Sorry for disturbing you and all that.
No, is it
an occasion?
Yes. Today's my birthday, so I kind of got brought away for it to Ross's Point.
Nice. It's nice up there. Yeah. What age are you, do you mind me asking?
Oh, I'm 45.
Nice. That's sort of midlife, isn't it? When I was 45, I thought that's midlife because, you know, I'd probably might if I'm really, really, really unbelievably lucky, and you're unbelievably lucky, live to 90. And 45, as we know, is midpoint between 0 and 90. Do you consider yourself to be middle aged now, Paul?
I probably have to start accepting that at some stage. But, holding out,
right. And who'd you go with?
I went with my fiance Mary. She's the one who organised this and brought me away, all right.
That's very nice of her. That's very nice.
Yeah, it was lovely.
I'm looking at your details here. So you had a career change, 10 years ago? Was it 10 years ago or there?
Yeah, roughly about that. Like I was kind of like in software engineering and development. And then I went back into education and done my master's in data analytics and statistics and kind of transferred over into now I'm a data scientist.
Right.
So you kind of know where I am now.
And they're saying data is the new oil.
That's it. That's what they're saying. And there's a lot of it.
There is an awful lot of it, isn't there?
Mining
that data, that's your speciality, I suppose.
Well, that's it. That's a big part of what we do. It's where we spend most of the time, actually. It's just looking at the data and trying to identify the patterns and make predictions or kind of extract some interesting knowledge from that data that we can make use of.
Right, it's a mad world, yeah. Okay, we won't keep you away from your break and your birthday celebrations and Mary for too long. So it's you could be winning for yourself another break after this. So it's three questions each. I'll play you three clips each. If you go for a long clip, you get a point. If you go for a shorter clip, it's more difficult. You get 2 points. Whoever has scored the most at the end on points will be the winner. If it's a draw, we go to a tie-break question. Good luck, Katrina. Good luck, Paul. Here we go.
Good luck, Katrina.
Okay, Katrina, the year is 1990. 1990 is the year, which is 32 years ago. And we're starting at the movies. So do you want to go for a long clip or a short clip?
Short clip.
Short clip, okay. Said with confidence. This romantic weepy starred Patrick Swayze as a man who dies and haunts his girlfriend Demi Moore. Can you name it? Here's your clip.
What do you mean? Why don't I ever say it? I say it all the time. I feel
no,
like...
No, you don't. You say ditto and that's not the same.
Oh, no. How many seconds have I got?
That's that you have to tell me now, really.
Oh, I can't think.
Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore, no.
I'm having a mental block here.
Dies and haunts his girlfriend. Nothing coming.
Oh my God.
No, it was. I have to tell you now. Ghost. There was that. There was that famous pottery scene in it.
Of course.
Yes. And the Righteous Brothers playing in the background. You lost that loving feeling, was it?
Oh.
Or something like that. No, okay, early days, Katrina, sorry, don't fret yet. Paul, to you, 1990 at the movies. Do you want a long one or a short one?
I'll go short. Thanks.
Short again. This film starred Macaulay Culkin and became an instant Christmas classic when it was released in 1990. Here's your short clip.
Fam, I'm 8 years old. You think I'd be here alone? I don't think so.
It's Home Alone.
Yeah, that was a bit of a gimme. You probably knew Ghost as well. But you get you get 2 points for that. Okay, back to you, Katrina. Music from 1990.
Short.
Short, okay. In 1990, one of the biggest female singers in the world at the time had a hit with this song. Can you name the song or the singer? Here's your short clip.
Spice Girls?
Oh, no!
No! I'm not doing very well at all.
No. That was Madonna and Vogue. Oh. Vogue. Mm-hmm. Now, this could be we could be finishing up quite soon by the looks of things. Paul, if you get anything from this question, Katrina can't catch her.
Oh, okay.
You see, that's yeah. You're the scientist on data, but yeah, if my maths are correct, yeah. If you get anything from this, so you can go along if you like.
I think I have to be long then.
Okay.
Yeah.
In 1990, this song became an anthem for Irish fans and also went to number one. Can you name the song or some of the singers on it?
We've qualified for the World Cup. Go and compete.
Oh, there you go.
On Derry Down?
Say
Derry Goon.
No. No, you see, Derry Doon is in the background there, but it's Put Him Under Pressure was the answer I was looking for. Yes, and it was the Irish soccer team, and that would have done me. But so you're still in with a chance, Katrina. Still in with a chance. I thought that was a gimme, Paul, but there you go. Okay, now if you get this right and Paul falters on the last one, we're madly into a tiebreak situation. Okay, so it's the news from 1990, Katrina. So you have to go short.
Okay, yeah. I definitely go short.
Yes, we have no choice. Right, in 1990, the UK Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher announced she would resign once a new leader of the Conservative Party was elected. Who became the new leader and later Prime Minister? And this is his voice, and we want his name for 2 points.
I believe it's time to see. And Margaret Thatcher's period as Prime Minister is seen in a proper perspective.
Is it John Major?
It is John Major, yes.
Woohoo!
Was that John Major or Margaret Thatcher? John Major was John Major, yes. You get 2 points for that. Now it's even. It's even. Paul, again, if you get anything from this, you are today's winner. However, if you get nothing from it, we're into a tiebreak situation. Okay. So what do you want to go, long or short?
I'd go long again.
Long. Okay. In 1990, workers on a project which ran between England and France finally broke through from one side to the other. What was this project called? Here's your long clip for 1 point.
He's been shouting to his English counterparts at the other side. Various people have come and inspected the small holes that have already been made. And as soon as they start, I think it could be very shortly after that we find ourselves looking through. They're about to go.
Very dramatic.
It's the Channel Tunnel.
It is.
The
Channel Tunnel. It finally opened in 1994. You're today's winner. Hard luck, Katrina.
Do you know what? Congratulations on happy birthday.
Yeah, you're
right. Thanks a million. Hard luck.
You rallied at the end there, but it wasn't enough. So we're going to send you out a couple of Ray Darcy Show mugs.
Oh, thank you
okay.
so much.
Okay, and lovely
Ray.
Talking
nice
to you, Katrina. Lovely
bye
talking
bye.
To you.
Take
Mind
care.
Yourself,
bye
stay
bye.
Safe. Bye bye. Well done, Paul. You're away again. yourself and Mary.
Thanks, Ray.
This time you're off to the 4-star Fairies Hotel located in the heart of Dundalk, and you can find out what's in store for you and I presume Mary. Fairieshotel.ie. Fairieshotel.ie. Happy birthday, great. Paul. Good luck. See you. Well done. Bye.
The
bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, Melly Murphy is one of Ireland's best-known lifestyle bloggers. Her YouTube videos have received 68 million views, with her fans appreciating her honest content on relationships, sexuality, confidence and mental health. Melanie is also an author with 3 books on the market. The first, a life guide and memoir. The second, a novel called If Only, and continued to forge her path in the literary world. She just released her latest book, that'll be book 3, Glass Houses, which is available everywhere now. And Melanie Murphy joins me in studio. Good afternoon, Melanie.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks.
Glass Houses. We've loads of things to talk about.
Yeah.
So you were on the TV show back in 2015, which is nearly 7 years ago.
Yeah, and I was fangirling. I took a selfie with you and I sent it to my family. I was like, look where I am.
But at that point, you were sort of on because you were making half a living out of YouTubing.
Yes. So it had become my full-time job at the time, but it wasn't really making me as much money as it kind of went on till like it became a proper career, I suppose.
Yes.
At the time, I was still very much expecting it to all fall apart in front of me every month to month. I couldn't believe it was still going. I started it while I was doing my degree in education in DCU, and it just kind of became a job very quickly.
A lot of our listeners, I say, they know that the phrase YouTuber, but they don't quite understand what you do.
It's a loaded term though, isn't it? I feel like YouTuber has become a slur because, you know, there's all the stories of when a YouTuber does an awful thing, that tends to make the mainstream news, like Logan Paul going into the forest, that kind of thing. But it's basically, I'm a one-man band and I run a channel myself and I film videos that I come up with the ideas, I edit them. A lot of people do hire help, but I'm just a bit of a control freak, so I like to do everything myself. And yeah, it's...
And you just talk about yourself and your life.
Yeah, it can sound very narcissistic. But it literally can. And you know, through my life, I suppose, I've aged so much online. So I started it in my early 20s and now I'm 32. I have a child. I've just recently bought my first house, which, you know, was a long journey. And so the types of things I talk about definitely change. But yeah, it is very much...
And can you explain it then, the appeal? You've been doing it for years. And you obviously must have thought about this.
Yeah,
what's the appeal?
I think it's similar to podcasts and radio, really. Like, you're listening to people's stories and you're wanting to connect with other people and have friendly voices in the background. Like, you know, if people listen to you, they feel, when they have you on, it's like a comfort thing. Mm. And they'd feel at home when they can hear your voice in the background. That's what people tell me anyway. I've multiple times asked, why do you watch me? What am I doing here? Because when I started, I didn't expect it to become this. I didn't realise, you know, I didn't even know you could turn the monetization on, which is what it's called, where YouTube will run ads on your videos so you can make money by the views, and then it's your channel views across the month determines your paycheck from YouTube.
And you're making a living out of it.
Yeah. I've been, and I do other work as well as a result of the channel. So the channel is kind of, you know, the spark of everything else that I do.
And we're going to get to the book because there's themes from your life running through the book as well,
albeit in a
fictional world. But you are sort of a professional oversharer then.
I am. And I've always said that since I was younger, I've definitely been an oversharer. And with YouTube, I always found it extremely cathartic to talk about stuff on camera. And it's like, I'm not going to say it's like talk therapy at all, but, you know, because I've done my fair share of therapy as well. But when you open up on camera about something and then the type of people that content will attract, so say if I'm talking about quitting alcohol, the people that will come to that video are in the same boat as you, or they've got some. And when I have meetups with my followers my online followers, we've so much in common. It's absolutely mad. Like, I know I would get on so well with them.
That, isn't that the brilliant thing about what you do, is that, people come to you because they've shared views?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's different when you're on a national radio station, because there's a myriad of people listening, and not everybody shares the same views as you. And that's the reality
part
of what
of the
we
job,
do.
Yeah.
So did you give up alcohol?
I did. I quit about three years ago now, and I never thought I'd be sitting here saying that. Like, I just have always had quite an unhealthy relationship, I suppose, with alcohol. Like, a lot of my unresolved childhood traumas and stuff would come out when I'd be drunk, and for years I kind of had rules set on myself, like, once I don't drink more than two drinks I'll be fine, which was the case most of the time, but if I ever had one too many, you know, it would bring out a nasty side of me. And essentially my husband and I, we weren't married yet, and we were going through some issues where a lot of my own problems we were in their heads when I'd be drinking, and it just kind of all exploded one night, and I said, like, enough is enough. And he was just like, I could tell that I could ruin the best thing that ever happened to me by choosing,
as in him.
Yeah, by choosing drink over my relationship, over my multiple relationships and my social life, my work. Like, it was even making me be less productive.
But you weren't drinking a lot.
I would drink a lot when I would drink.
Oh, would you?
So, yeah, and it would be a weekly thing, you know.
And would you call yourself an alcoholic?
No.
No.
No, no. And I think, and there are, some people have labelled me that, but I've never, that term has never resonated with me because I've never been like the type of person to need a drink to get through the day ever. It's just more that
you
negative
a problem
patterns.
With drink.
And I think a lot of people in this country do, because it's so part of our culture and it's so expected of you. And when I gave it up, it was the first 6 months were really hard, and after that was fine. But people constantly kind of, sure, one isn't going to do any harm. That is just so pervasive, and it's so difficult to...
We'll talk again about that, because we're running out of time. We have to talk about the book.
Yes.
So Glass Houses, so it's Rosie and Jenna, and their sisters, and they're the main characters.
Yes, they are.
The main characters. And then there's Peter, who's a singer-songwriter, and they both have an interest in him. And then there's Peter's dad, who's a retired doctor, who feels that he owes something to a lot of his former patients. And that's where the glass house comes in.
You've done your homework. This is great. I don't even have to tell you.
I
don't even have to tell you anything. I know. So David, a retired doctor, he brings this bunch of people all struggling with different mental health conditions together to fix up his old garden that he shared with his wife, who is now dead, and he shares a connection with her in his mind. He still shares a very strong connection with her, and he can communicate with her, and other people don't see it that way. It's a book very much about healing and reconnecting with other people and reconnecting with nature, and those are things that I think,
that book you read about connection, what's his name?
Oh, Johan Harry.
Yes.
It's a book called Lost Connections, and it's fantastic. It's about anxiety and depression, two things that the majority of people will, you know, like meet those, I suppose, in their life, whether it's you or a family member. But he really goes into all of the causes of anxiety and depression, and a couple of them are not external, like they're things that, the types of things that medication will really help, like if those are issues for you. But a lot of the things he talks about are environmental and things that, you know, you can impact change on, you can.
So, and connection is one of them, isn't it?
Connection. And like, obviously through the pandemic we were all experiencing isolation from family and friends, and a lot of us, I think, did reconnect with nature because we were going outside more. We were getting so fed up of our phones. And I started the book before the pandemic hit. I was very inspired by The Secret Garden, which I loved as a child. And I thought, how could I write that, a version of that for adults? You know, like, how could I spice that up and have it appeal to older folk like me? But during the pandemic, I think because I was writing it through that and through pregnancy and everything, it all of that kind of shaped the book. And now when I look at the book and read the book, just so much coming through in it.
And say right, they say right what you know, and your husband Tom, is it Tom?
No. Thomas. Yeah,
Thomas.
Yeah.
Sorry, not Tom. Thomas. he's a pilot, and Rosie in the book is a pilot.
She was a pilot and had to give up her job, and I think that came from during the pandemic. He didn't know if he'd get to fly anymore. Right. And I was seeing how that was killing him to the thought of this career he'd always dreamed of.
And did you spread out you bits of you between the two sisters, Rosie and Jenna?
I think so, yeah. I definitely took aspects of myself. I think it's very hard not to have some of yourself in your book, because a book doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes from all of your experiences, all of everything that's ever existed in your brain, everything you've ever seen, heard. It will all filter through. And I think with me, a lot of my followers will pick up on little things like, oh, I feel like this is very reminiscent of you in this way. And it's because they know me in so many ways that you don't know a lot of other authors.
It's interesting. We were talking to Mary O'Connor last week, and she's a sex therapist.
Oh, wow.
And she's been working for years now. She's retired. But she was saying that she didn't think a lot of women watch porn. And,
yes.
and I was going, I don't think you're right there.
Yeah.
And this is something that you write about, as in Rosie does it, and you've talked about it yourself.
Yes, I wrote about it in my first book. It's called Fully Functioning Human Almost. And I think it's something that there can't be no consequence to limitless free pornography, and it's constantly becoming more and more extreme, and young people are being educated by this as well. And yeah, I think the fact that women are very, it's not just men, women very much partake in this as well, and can become very reliant on it.
And when did you have a problem? Did you think you had a...
I ended up just banning myself from it, entirely for 6 months, because I just felt that it was taken over a little bit, and I was burying my head in that, and I was using that as an escape, and I wanted to explore that through a character.
It's escape from your reality.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a distraction, and but then as soon as it's over, you're still faced with your problems are still there.
Yeah.
It's like with a lot of things that we kind of use to hide from stuff that's going on.
Yeah, well, drugs or drink or whatever it is.
Yes.
Gambling, all those addictions. I suppose there is an addiction to porn. So your relationship with YouTube now. Because you have a child.
I do, yeah. It's now, changed a lot.
Has it? Yeah. Go on.
I think I've become more private, and I'm constantly trying to figure out what my boundaries are now and what I do and don't want to share. And because I don't share his name or his face online, a lot of people, when they were, you know, following me when I was pregnant, I was very happy to share what it's like going through that. And all of anything to do with me, I'm happy enough to talk about. But with him, I know he can't consent to me sharing his identity. Like, I don't want him to grow up and be able to Google himself and find my 20s splashed across the internet.
But he'd be able to Google you, and he'll know,
all
the things you spoke about.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose.
And how do you feel about that?
I think that's one of those things that, like, no one really knows how
it's going to pan out, do they?
Yeah, no, because this is all so new.
Yes, like, it all.
And
yes.
All of my friends, you know, I know people going back who have Facebook pages going back, God, how many years now? How long is that around? 12 years or something? Probably more.
Yes.
And, you know, they've put so much of themselves on there. So it's not just an issue, I suppose, for content creators like me. It's just
How do you think it's going to pan out?
I think, well, I'm noticing a kind of trend now with a lot of celebrity children who are growing up to really resent their parents for oversharing their childhoods and posting very intimate details about their personalities and their first this and their first that. And I think for me, this is where I'm very much taking a step back at the minute and trying to think of ways I can shift my content. Like, I'm very attracted to the idea of doing video essays and stuff like that are a little bit more, you know, I have to put in the time into, you know, studying a subject and
but they're not about you.
It's not necessarily about me and my family and my life. Yeah. But I don't mind sharing the odd thing about that. But that has been carrying me and my job for so many years. But now, you know, I have my family, which I've always dreamed of, and I want to enjoy that in private. Yeah. I want to enjoy a lot more of it in private. And yeah,
it's interesting because it's something we are all going through. The world's going through, and that this seismic change that we've been offered through technology, we don't know how it's going to, what consequences it's going to have.
Exactly. We still don't know how to deal
with it. What we do know is Glass Houses is in bookshops now. Melanie Murphy's second novel, and well worth a read. Melanie, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cormac is up next with Drive Time. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday evening.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.